I was definitely rooting for the Carolina Hurricanes last night. And not because I care about the Hurricanes at all. In fact, I've had a lot of difficulty just watching that series. Not because I'm like, oh, the Leafs were so close. That was the true Eastern Conference Final. I just think it was not really a compelling series. The Hurricanes got the doors blown off them in the first couple of games, and we got this discussion point that we said we get every year of, does this mean the Leafs should run it back because a team was good in the playoffs that beat them? Hey, everyone. I've been noticing the Leafs lose to good teams. I think that's proof of concept. I'm like, ugh. It happens every year. It aggravates me to no end. I cannot stand it when I hear it from people I know. It drives me crazy to see it when people like Paul Bissonnette put it out there over and over again. I can't. It drives me crazy. It's nuts. Like, I this is off the top of my head, but I think this is right. Like, Mitch Marner, I believe, in games 5, 6, 7, his last 21 games, 5, 6, and 7, has no goals and 7 assists. Okay? Let's just reflect on that for a second. By comparison, go look at how many goals Connor Brown has this postseason. Go look at how many goals, man, Zach Hyman had this postseason, like former Leafs players, right? That are in, like, on other teams. And there's this like notion out there for some people where you just can't replace the talent. Like, you can't replace the talent. And we become so focused on asset management as, frankly, fans and observers of the hockey team that I think we lose sight of things like that. And we lose sight of the big picture going, wait, we've already said the run it back thing multiple times based on losing to a good opponent. Oh, was it that embarrassing to lose to Montreal in hindsight since they made it to the cup final? Like, these things have been had before. These conversations have been had before. So today is, I don't know if I should say a big day, but it's one of the last big days for the Leafs until we get to free agency or until some rumor cracks that's more definitive than the stuff we have right now, because Brad Treliving is speaking at 10 a.m. today. So in about an hour, we're going to listen to Treliving, and I'm going to come off of it, and I'm going to share a few thoughts, and I'll probably break it down more in detail the following day. But Treliving speaks, which is a little bit especially interesting, I would say, given that this is now 2 weeks after the dust has settled. Like, we've got the Panthers going through to the finals. Stanley Cup final is not set. Oilers' job's not finished. Sucks about Zach Hyman. People were mad at me because I thought it was devastating Zach Hyman got hurt. I went, I don't know. One of the guys who tries the hardest has continued to evolve his game, plays the right way, is a great guy. Him not being able to play in a Stanley Cup final potentially after all this work and having an injury-plagued history that he kind of overcame to get right back there for the revenge and then not be able to play, that's pretty devastating to me. I thought, as a hockey fan, I like Zach Hyman. No, I was able to get out of bed. I thought that we could use language like that on Twitter. I guess not. I guess not. So people were like, how dare you invoke this language? But this isn't as raw as these things usually are, right? We see players go to podiums and they have to speak after they get bounced in the postseason, and we get these like really crappy answers and there's not really much to it. But you go, okay, well, you can kind of forgive him, right? The feeling of the wound is still so fresh. And not to say that Treliving isn't still feeling this thing, but we've had a bit of time here. Players go, they waited all the way until Friday for Keith Pelley to address the media. Now Brad Treliving gets the benefit of an added week. So it's been a week since the firing of Brendan Shanahan officially. So I don't know if it's okay for him to kind of act like, oh, well, I'm just getting my bearings here. Like, you've had dinners, you've had meetings, you've been able to talk to your leadership group at this point, most certainly, you've been able to talk to your coaching staff, the rest of your front office, all these different people that you've been able to kind of click in on. This should be something from Treliving today. And I'm curious to see if this actually translates in terms of what I think the mandate was sort of outlined by the CEO, who has been talking about better relationships with the media, who's been talking about transparency. He was on Keith Pelley was on the 100% Hockey podcast with Millard and Shannon, and he was asked about the team in critical moments, and this was his answer. Quote, "It would be a better question for the players and coaches, but I would say we made strides this year." You're like, okay, but the players and coaches didn't really answer that. They didn't. So I'm curious, probably more so than anything, if the general manager, the guy that's the head of all this, is going to actually have some answers for it. Like, what's he going to say about three things to me? There are three things that I'm most curious about when it comes to Tree Living's media conference today. What he thinks of the culture. What's different between he and Brendan Shanahan? Because again, he's had a week to sit on this now. He's had a week to sit on this. I don't expect him to throw Brendan Shanahan on the bus. I think that he's going to be very complimentary, just like anybody would be, right? Like, somebody gets fired from your job and you don't just immediately like go public and start telling everybody that you don't know, that you don't trust, all your little nitty gritty feelings. But you will go, you got to say something in terms of you basically getting a promotion, why this is your job. And I know technically he's not getting a promotion. He's not the president, but he is now the direct line. And it's been said over and over by Pelley, this is his team. This is Brad's team now. And so I am really curious what he views as the difference, how he views this is either going to free him up, how this is going to make his job more difficult is easy for him to say, because he'll be like, hey, this is a guy who I was able to bounce ideas off of, blah, 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 blah. How is it actually going to be different under you? What is the main thing that you see as different? And I don't think that this is actually too much to ask, because we've had presidents and general managers in the city that are open and honest. The Blue Jays guys don't really subscribe to it. They're not great at it. Masai Ujiri is incredible at it. He really does. You got to give Masai credit. He will open up. He will tell you things. There have been other guys in the hockey world who have opened up and who had given you some more of those answers. Brian Burke, obviously, famously for it. But this was something that kind of stuck out to me. This was from Keith Pelley on the 100% Hockey podcast. He was asked about transparency. He said, that's where it kind of gets a little bit tricky. In the playoffs, everyone is playing the injury game, and I understand that. But you built the whole respect throughout the year. You can understand that, right? But the transparency thing is also explaining why you can't tell or do things. Does that make sense? So he's there. I'm interpreting that around the injury stuff where he's like, you have to explain why you can't tell someone why someone's hurt. But he also seems to care about transparency. And so for the general manager today to take to the podium, I'm probably putting a little too much on this. Like, honestly, I get it. I understand how someone could be like, man, who cares? But if one of the things of the old era for the Leafs was, hey, we are going to be more of a private silo. We are going to be a little bit more of a non-transparent entity. Because that was a Lou Lamoriello thing. That was a Shanahan thing. Dubas took that by the horns, and they just really never relented from that. It was like, hey, we're going to do PR, 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 but keep everything at a distance. I'm curious to see if the first day of the Tree Living era, quote unquote, right, where it's no more Shanahan, this is now Tree Living's team. If he comes out and he presents Leafs fans with real thoughts on this hockey team, where does he stand on the free agents? I don't think he's going to say we're not negotiating with Marner, right? He's going to say, yeah, we'll hear Mitch. He wants to go to free agency and we'll circle back with him and we'll talk about it. I think he'll say the same thing about Tavares and we'll be non-committal. But I am curious to see if he actually is going to say that certain things in the organization need to change, because to me, a lot of people think they do. And I'm not talking about fans. I'm not talking about just all of us sitting in the seats paying money for the $20 beers. I'm talking about what he actually perceives have been some of the problems with this group and whether he feels like he has at least what he thinks to be some of the answers on this. And by the way, last thing that I know he'll address the pressure. I know he'll be asked about the pressure and whether he thinks he has the kind of players to play in the market and go on down the line with that. But ultimately, the more I've reflected on the market pressure stuff, the more I've really thought about, like, hey, Toronto is such a hard place to play and the players, and they don't want the circus. the more I've now convinced myself, that is just a weird feedback loop we do in this city. That's just something we do as fans and observers of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Like, we perpetuate this narrative of like, no, nobody wants to play here. Some guys don't want to play here because the circus. To be honest, I think that some guys don't want to play here. And a big part of it actually just has to do with like the lifestyle they like, and that it doesn't really have to do with it being a circus. People want to play here if the team is good. And that's what's lost sometimes in the no state tax stuff, right? And we've talked about this, but you look at it and go, hey, Florida winning culture, Dallas now winning culture, right? Tampa winning culture that they built up in these places. If Toronto has a winning culture and they've got a team that really feels like it's on the rise, like it did when these young players were first coming up and they looked like they were going to be perennial cup winners, at least in the eyes of all of us that were getting really excited about it when we were comparing them to the Blackhawks, or no, maybe they're the Penguins and we were doing all this stuff. I don't remember as much of a conversation about the difficulty of getting guys to sign here. And in fact, again, John Tavares signed here. That's a pretty big rarity where a Toronto-born player or any NHL player ends up leaving their organization in their prime to go join somebody else. It felt like a huge deal at the time. Like, Toronto actually has proof of concept of being able to attract stars like Tavares. They just signed Chris Tanev to, again, another guy that was a massive free agent. Someone who everybody coveted. They've had multiple guys. They traded for Jake Muzzin, but then they were able to re-sign him. He was a guy who would have been coveted, would have had a lot of options in free agency. Like, this team hasn't had problems with signing free agents. And yet here we are always with like, well, do guys want to play here? Well, do guys want to play here? Which is so funny to me because I feel like it's a feedback loop. It's this urban legend. The Raptors fans get furious. Blue Jays fans get furious when people bring up like, oh, well, I don't know if baseball players or basketball players want to play in Toronto. There's actual evidence of former players going, yeah, Toronto is kind of tough on me and my family. We've heard about free agents going, yeah, I considered Toronto, but at the end of the day, it was kind of tough to be this far from my family or to go live in a new country. It wasn't for everybody. Hockey, there's far more Canadians. Way more people understand the market in the sport in general, because if you're raised up in hockey, you're going to be at least generally aware of the Toronto Maple Leafs. You're going to be aware of how big the viewership is in Toronto compared to what you're doing in Florida. And yet, despite the fact that, again, there's evidence for Raptors fans and Jays fans, their mentality is like, you don't want to play here? Screw you. You don't like Toronto? We don't need you. And that's for players that have been good here. Look how people reacted to Lou Williams. He was beloved. And the second Lou was like, yeah, I don't know, Toronto, and had a couple of doubts about the customs, people were like, yep, we hate you now. They're like, damn, Lou Williams? We loved Lou. That was a really fun season. And yet with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who actually signed free agents, said like, where are the players that have come out and said this publicly? We've done it privately where we guess, where we're like, oh, did Ryan O'Reilly not want to play here because of the circus? It's like, I don't know. I heard that he didn't really like the playing for the coach. And yeah, the market probably didn't help, but did he ever come out and say that? Was there ever Ryan O'Reilly on a podcast? Did he ever go on Spittin' Chiclets and say like, ah, I won't be a Maple Leaf? Like, it is so strange to me that we do this with this hockey team, despite never really hearing from players. What do former players all say about playing for Toronto? And yes, I usually talk to the ones who are loved here, but they're like, yeah, I love my time in Toronto. Wow, the market cared so much. I loved how it kept me sharp. I just watched a clip of Carmelo Anthony talk about this playing for the Knicks, where he was talking about how he loved the pressure that came with being a New York Knick because it made it sure that he never showed up and wasn't 100% himself. And I feel like a lot of hockey players feel the same way. Very few have come out and publicly trashed playing in Toronto. Usually, it's outsiders who I think are jealous a little bit. Like, you don't think Matthew Tkachuk, a guy who loves attention, would want to bring something up about Toronto and how it's hard on the players and all this weird stuff? Like, of course he would. He likes attention. Brad Marchand likes attention. And they're in markets where they don't get a fraction of what Toronto gets. So, I'm not particularly interested in the Brad Treliving answer about the market pressure today, and I think that'll probably be a big part of it, but simply because it's like, yeah, where's it coming from? I think the call is coming from inside the house on this stuff, that it's all of us that keep perpetuating this anti-Toronto sentiment when it comes to playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs, when in reality, it's like, who did you get it from? Where did this come from? Raptors fans, you got examples. Blue Jays fans, you got examples. Every free agency, I don't know if guys want to go pitch there. Like, that used to be a big thing. What's the Maple Leafs example? I don't really think there is one. I think it's kind of the most overblown thing in this market. So for Tree Living, I want to hear where you stand on the players. I want to hear what you think is different between you and Brendan Shanahan. And I want to hear if you really do think that there is something about these guys in big games or big moments or something that is a missing ingredient that this team needs moving forward. Anyways, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I'm going to chat with my buddy Ben Nicholson-Smith.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So huge moment for Bo Bichette yesterday. Monster pinch hit home run during a time where all we're doing is talking about where's Bo Powers gone. But don't forget Paxton Schultz and Eric Lauer, who combined for an unbelievable start. And this is one of my curiosities, actually, about this Blue Jays season is that, okay, the five hole has been absent of talent, right? And have they had some bad Nathan Lucas games? Nathan Lucas? I hope I have that right. I feel like Easton Lucas. Nathan Lucas is someone else. There were a couple baddies in there at the very end where he got absolutely tattooed. I think that probably when teams get a little bit more information on some of these pitchers, they're able to, yeah, do that to them. Like, I don't think Paxton Schultz over the course of a season is going to be giving you three strong with shutout innings every single time he goes out there. Eric Lauer, though, has been actually semi-decent. And it's kind of funny that Jays still sit here one game under 500. And if you just looked at the roster, right, if you would have looked at without any statistics and you just saw, hey, this is how the season has evolved, you would have gone, what, Scherzer got hurt in the first game? And they've been dealing with these guys. Oh, surely they're the reason why it's the season is a game under 500. No, it's not really it. Ben Nicholson-Smith of the At the Letters podcast, Blue Jays reporter. What's up, buddy? How are we doing?
JD, going well over here. Kind of wild, as you said, that the Blue Jays were able to win the way they did. I mean, it's a Josh Smith single away from a no-hitter. I mean, that's yeah. I feel like we're almost looking past that, they one-hit the Texas Rangers. I know it's not a good offense, but that was kind of a wild game yesterday.
Yeah, and listen, I think part of it is that we've watched now a couple games of the Rangers offense, and we go, oh, that's bad. That's really bad. That's not very good. There's one guy in the entire lineup that is really scary, right, and Wyatt Langford. And then some of the guys that they were relying on years past, like when we just saw them in the World Series, have just become bad overnight. Like Marcus Semien, not good anymore. Adolis Garcia, not good anymore. But yeah, that was a really impressive start. And I don't even really know what to make of it, man, because like my prevailing thought today was just simply kind of what I outlined right as you were coming on is that hasn't killed them. They've had bad outings from those guys, but the fifth starter spot this season has not been an abject disaster. They've been able to actually cobble this thing together and figure out on the fly how to deal with it. And it's actually sneaky work for this team. Like, it's not, is it a long-term problem? Yes. But has it been one of like of the main reasons why this team still sits a game below 500? No.
Yeah. No, I think that's completely fair. And it is kind of remarkable because no one was talking about Paxton Schultz like at all. And Eric Lauer too was pretty much off the radar for the entirety of spring training. Like, they weren't even considered, you know, depth guys. Lauer was behind to start the season. So right now for them to be contributing like this is really good. And it speaks to the overall pitching staff where you have a bullpen right now that has been awesome. Like, with the exception of a couple Jeff Hoffman outings where, you know, some hitters took some great swings against him, we're talking about a bullpen that's jumped into the top 10 of baseball after being like bottom two down there with the Rockies last year. So they needed this, and you don't want the strength of your team to be the bullpen, but if you actually have like a little bit of major league pitching depth to the point where a starter gets knocked out early and you can turn the ball over to a Schultz or a Lauer or Yariel and feel pretty good about that, I mean, that's a good thing. They just need more swings like the one that Bo Bichette gave them last night, and they didn't get a lot of those on the road trip.
Yeah, this is literally the theme of the year for me that I just keep coming back to is like, You got to have power for that exact reason, is one swing to completely change the makeup of a baseball game. And they haven't had enough of that this year. Like, what does that resemble? Playoff baseball. And what do you need in the playoffs is home runs. And what do the Blue Jays not have? Home runs. And like two games that they win in the series, come simply because they ended up getting a homer, right? Like, that's it. That's all you can boil this thing down to, is that the Jays beat the Texas Rangers to being able to hit a home run. One from Varsho, one from Bo Bichette. So he was supposed to sit that game out because, like, back spasm stuff. But I guess when you hit a home run during the back spasm thing, I'm not supposed to be concerned about this at all. But yeah, I at least had my antenna up last night when I'm hearing all the stuff about, like, him having this rest day. He plays all the time. And part of me was like, oh, they're just picking a spot here. They maybe feel as though this was a game they were scheduled to lose, where it's Molly versus their fifth starters being stuck together in a way that I'm sure they didn't anticipate them having that kind of success. But yeah, Bo's season last year was marred with, hey, he's hurt, he's probably too hurt, he's probably too hurt. Anything for you on this, like the back stuff? Back tightness, back spasming? I don't know. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Well, as you said, for him to come and hit a home run, that's pretty much the best way to ease those concerns, probably.
But Kirk Gibson hit a home run. Kirk Gibson hit a home run. So I was like, oh, is it one of those?
Yeah. Thankfully, Bichette looked a little more comfortable rounding the bases than Kirk Gibson did or Freddie Freeman did last year. So, you know, hopefully he's fine. We'll obviously see how they're doing. The Jays landed super late. You know, they get on a plane. That's not always the best thing for a tight back, for someone who's dealing with that kind of tightness. They're doing a late start to their day today. They're probably not going to hit. Everyone's scheduled to arrive late to the stadium today. So we'll see if Bo Bichette is in there. I think it's still somewhat of an unknown, but I got to say, seeing that swing and seeing him hit that home run, it does ease the concerns, at least for the time being.
Yeah, so I'll come back to the power in a second, but my last thought on the starting pitchers from last night is, so Lauer, they've brought in as this piggyback starter now a couple of times, right? I think he did it against the Padres with some success. Obviously, this game, really great success. Bowden Francis just had this really good outing. You and I were actually texting back and forth about it. The velo was up a little bit. He was locating his pitches. He looked like the Bowden Francis from a year ago, but that's been few and far between this year. Like, if you were going to point to a trouble spot, hey, what has really killed you from a starting pitching standpoint? I would say that, yeah, the fifth spot has been better than Bowden Francis. And I think that, like, that actually bears out statistically. And I'm curious if you think that there is actually a roster spot battle here over the coming month. Like, I know Turnbull is still very early in his buildup. He's had, I think, 3 appearances now, and he just went, I think, 4 innings of his first, like, halfway decent start in, where is it? He's in Dunedin? Yeah, I can't even remember. But either way, he's building up. He's trying to get ready. He's far from a guarantee, right? Like, I don't know. It's a guy that didn't pitch, and we'll see. We'll see with him. But if he was to emerge as a guy that they're like, yeah, we really want to give this guy a start or two, like, we really want this guy to be coming up, do you think that there's a chance that Bowden Francis and Eric Lauer are actually competing for the fifth starter spot?
I don't see that as the immediate move that the Blue Jays would make. I think when you look at Bowden Francis and how good he was last year, even how good he was against the Rangers in that most recent start, I think that there's enough sort of equity that he's built up within this coaching staff where they are going to roll with him and they are going to work with him to make sure that they can get really good production and get it closer to where it was last year. Now, he's probably got to find a way to increase his strikeout rate. That's dropped off by 3 percentage points this year. Even last year, it was close to league average. Now it's below league average. You want to have that put away pitch. Clearly the home runs, you know, that's an issue as well. A lot of this will come down to location, because if he's able to locate those pitches on the edges of the strike zone, then maybe you're getting more strikeouts and you're not allowing those home runs. So that's something that I expect the Jays to work with, but I think the logical, easy move to make if you have someone like Spencer Turnbull ready is maybe you just pair Spencer Turnbull with Eric Lauer, especially because Turnbull is not going to be, you know, stretched out to 100 pitches necessarily right away.
No.
And even if he is, you know, this is a guy who's done some starting, some relieving. So, you know, he's used to working in different roles. He's not someone that you have to hand the ball to for 7 innings every night. So maybe you just pair those guys together, keep Paxton Schultz in a long relief role, Yariel in a long relief role, and you can use it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's the thing. You know, that's actually been probably, if I was doing the things that have really seemed to emerge as real positives for the Jays, it's like with these guys early on, and even when they had the Easton Lucas experiment, Like, and he would get shelled and he'd have to come out of the baseball game. The bullpen to me feels way more rested now on a regular basis. It was like, God, they're pressing these guys, right? We were throwing graphics up on the TV being like, this is the projected usage for these bullpen arms. It felt like Chad Green was pitching every night, like every single night Chad Green was getting into the baseball game. Now it just feels a little bit more normal. Like the starters have given them some length now for a couple of weeks. There haven't been these blow up spots where all of a sudden guys are having to come in. But even if they do, like even in these spots, right, it feels as though the Jays have actually found a couple of guys who can give them multiple innings and not be horrific, 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 like beyond Yariel Rodriguez. And I got to say, like, that is in terms of things that I'm sort of buying into that they've found money on the bullpen, the high leverage guys. That's great. But the fact is, I do feel some measure of confidence in Fisher and Schultz, less so, even though yesterday was nice. But Lauer, like, these guys seem capable. That feels really important for the long-term health of the bullpen.
Yeah, agreed. I think even, you know, today, right, going into a series with Oakland, that's a team that can really hit. So maybe Hoffman's down. Obviously, you're not going to use Lauer. But otherwise, they're in a pretty good spot going into this series with Oakland. Mm-hmm. So that's been the case more often than not for the course of that road trip. Like, they only used Brendan Little once in that whole road trip. And Little, too, I mean, he's just been pretty outrageous. I mean, he's probably one of the best left-handed relievers in baseball to this point in the season, probably one of the top 10 lefty relievers. So that's a weapon when it comes to the swing and miss that he can get. His pitches are almost so nasty that, like, if there's a runner on third, like, you almost think about, should you bring him in, or is there a lot of risk here? But you give him a clean inning, like, it's incredible what he can do with that curveball. So I think that the overall bullpen depth has really flipped since last year. They're in a really good spot where they have impact guys. They have lefties. They have righties. Fluharty stepped up. Obviously, Fisher, Paxton Schultz, Yariel's taken a step forward. And then you have the addition of Hoffman. So I think that this bullpen looks good. But again, you can't ride a bullpen to a championship. You got to get there with some offense, and you got to get there with some starting pitching. So the Blue Jays have some things to figure out, and it's great that they have this bullpen. It is a necessary step forward, but still, we've got to be talking about a better offensive team, because their offense has been, you know, obviously very rough for the last week, and even zooming out to the full season, they're pretty ordinary. They're right in the middle of the pack when it comes to the offensive stats for overall production. So they have work to do, and man, it would be great if Gausman could kind of sustain this front line starting quality of pitching, because they could really use that from him.
Honestly, it's even from the standpoint of the Gausman, it's like if the season ends up not working out and they continue to sort of go this way where they're dropping out of the playoff race, having Gausman look like an ace is massively important to them too, because like he becomes their number one trade piece.
Probably. I mean, unless you keep him. I mean,
sure, that's tough to picture if they're like out of it. No,
I guess it depends on how you view 2026. And this is like, you know, similar to the question that we were all discussing last year. It's like, okay, if you're out of it for this year, then what kind of timeline are you looking at for being relevant again? And if the Blue Jays think that, hey, you have Manoa coming back, you have a lot of minor leaguers coming up, maybe 2026 can be like a decent year, then you're probably going to hold on to Gausman a little tighter. If you're willing to do like a one-year reset and, okay, Namala, Yesavage, Cal Steven, maybe these guys are more 2027 impact players than 2026, then maybe you try to get a boatload for someone like a Kevin Gausman and potentially even a Jose Berríos. Obviously getting way ahead of things right now, and the Blue Jays want to be buyers and not sellers, but those are, I think, kind of loose possibilities to keep in mind.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely keeping the Gausman thing in mind, and I'll tell you right now that if they look like this team and in this watered-down, terrible American League, like that's just got to be – it's always on your mind is how bad the American League is, and the understanding of like, well, you know, you can kind of squint and see something – like again, that Rangers game, that team is awful. Like you're about to face this A's team that somehow is 1-9 in their last 10, despite playing in the American League. Like Angels bad, Rangers bad, Athletics bad, White Sox bad, Orioles bad, Red Sox. Like it's just a lot of bad teams. I was watching, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was Tigers Guardians or Tigers Twins. I was watching some AL Central game like earlier in this week during the day. And the two commentators were like, this is the best division in baseball. This is, say it with your chest. If you look at it, it's the most teams above 500. And I watch those teams. Like, the Royals kind of stink. They got a good bullpen, just like the Jays, but they don't hit, just like the Jays. They've got one superstar player, and they've gotten some good starting pitching. Same thing, it's like the Twins. I don't look at this Twins team as like, oh, nobody could beat them. And the Tigers and the Yankees were at like the very top of the pile in the American League East, or in the American League in general. I don't view them as unstoppable juggernauts that you could just never possibly get on to that level. They've got things you don't have, but I get that case. But also, it's like, yeah, I don't want to see a deadline where the Jays are bad and trying to buy fringe pieces instead of selling guys that they should obviously be able to get hauls for. Either way, so back to this, the here and now. You talked about the offense, and it's really just impossible not to put so much of this down to one guy right now, which is Anthony Santander. And you're probably going nuts because I'm texting you like every at-bat, which is rude.
I won't repeat the text. Let's just say
no,
that.
No, but it's like, I've been saying this for a long time now where it's not early anymore with Anthony Santander. And I was talking to Keegan Mathison about this yesterday, and I think I actually texted it to you as well. Why do you think they're so reserved in terms of putting him on the IL? Because if he keeps talking about his hip and you're getting a 580 OPS guy who is giving you bat at bat after bat at bat, don't you at some point want to just protect the guy and give him a mental reset and just say, yeah, short IL stint. What are we really missing here? Like, what are we losing in Anthony Santander when he's playing this way, especially since there's no secondary tool, right? He's not going out in the outfield and giving you something like, okay, well, Varsho's struggling, great. Who cares? He's the best center fielder defensively in baseball. You know, Kirk's struggling. Who cares? He's a super plus defensive player behind the plate. Like, Santander does nothing for you if he's not slugging and if he's not giving you power. And if this narrative is out there, or there's these reports out there about the hip and he likes hitting from one side of the plate more than the other, why the reluctance to just say, hey, man, take 10 days?
I think so. I'll answer that question really directly, but I'll first say that I get the argument that you're making here because, yeah, I think that there's a case for just letting him heal up and letting him have a breather mentally and physically. So I follow that line of thinking. Now, to answer the question as to why they wouldn't do that, I think that with injuries, you're working in tandem with the player. And so you're going to be talking to them and saying, hey, what do you need? What's your level of pain? Is this normal for you? Have you played through this before? And then, of course, you know, in some cases, you're going to do imaging, you're going to do kind of objective testing and examine it. But if it's more of that day-to-day territory, you're really relying on the player to guide you and to say, all right, this is fine. Like, I'm not feeling 100%, but I played through this in Baltimore last year, hit 44 homers that year. Like, I should be fine. And so if the player says that, and this is a major league veteran who's done played through lots of nagging injuries in the course of his career, you're going to take that into account. Now, at a certain point, maybe you just say, look, man, we're going to make this call for you. But clearly it hasn't gotten to that point yet.
Can I say that I think it has gotten to that point?
Right. I mean, they haven't gotten to that decision, but it's a reasonable thing to push for.
The thing is, there was like a moment a week ago where he was actually at least starting to put some decent at bats together. And I went, oh, okay, maybe he's coming out of this. Because he's working counts, and it's funny. I was yesterday watching the broadcast. Arden did a piece on like, hey, maybe this team is just like a little unlucky at the plate, right? He was doing like, hey, the expected batting average versus what the actual batting average is, and some of the runners in scoring position stuff, outlining some of the highlights. And you're like, yeah, okay, I can kind of wrap my head around that. But you know who you're not saying that about? It Anthony Santander. None of these at-bats, you're like, wow, so unlucky again. Oh, poor guy, he's snake bit. I think like probably in the last 2 weeks, I can count one AB where he should have drawn a walk because the umpire missed a call, and then he ends up getting, I think he got struck out on the next pitch. It's like, yeah, he's not been unlucky. His at-bats look really, really awful. They look, they're terrible. They're really bad. And it feels as though he is kind of praying for walks a lot of times. Like, this is not Mr. On Base, right? This isn't Mr. Hit for Average. So when I'm watching him take certain pitches, I'm going, dude, this looks like a guy whose confidence is shot right now. And for this team to say, like, hey, we got to keep waiting, we got to keep waiting, I'm like, I don't know, man. This feels I expect he's going to get hot at some point this season, right? There's going to be one point in the season where he's going to get red hot and people are going to go, oh, look, guys like JD that didn't believe in this guy. He's got five home runs in a week. As of right now, I think that he is genuinely the worst player on the team. And I think he's 160th out of 161st out of 166 qualified players in Fangraphs WAR. I can't have that in my lineup right now. And the patience has got to be wearing thin. It's like, you can't get it going against the Oakland Athletics, whose starting pitching staff has not been good. Like, they can hit. You mentioned it. They can't pitch. So you can't get hits against these guys. And I think that this is sort of the series where you look at it and go, this is it. You do it now or you sit for 10 days.
Yeah, their pitching staff is not very strong. I was just doing a little research here before we were talking. And yeah, they can really hit, but they've got this this lefty going tonight, Jacob Lopez, you know, making his fifth career start. So they have the advantage, going up against a soft-tossing lefty who's barely pitched in the major leagues. You want to take advantage of that. Now, Santander's the kind of player who, what he does is hit homers. He's not a singles hitter. He's not the, you know, with Vladdy, he's such a complete hitter to where he's hitting opposite field singles and he's hitting doubles into the gap and he's drawing walks. Yeah. And this is why he's a $500 million player. He can go through stretches where he hits seven homers in 2 months, but he does so many other things offensively that he's still a really good offensive player. Santander is not a complete offensive player like that. Few players are. And so he's not going to hit you a bunch of singles. He's not going to draw you a bunch of walks. It has to be the home runs, especially because, as you said, he's not a defense-first player. He's not a base-running-first player. So you need the home runs. And when he's not hitting home runs, it's not going to look good. And that's what we're seeing right now. And there clearly is a health component, too, with the shoulder and the hip. So I think that all explains why it's been the way it has so far. But to me, if I'm saying, like, let's say from June the 15th onward, like, what OPS would you expect for Anthony Santander? Because I would expect him to be like 780, 800, something like that. What would your expectation be?
The guy I'm seeing right now, it's not 780. Like, again, I could see a hot streak. I think that there's going to be more power, but like I see a guy who genuinely looks like just completely lost at the plate. Is not the hitter that we saw in Baltimore. I think he's changed his approach. And my understanding of Santander is that he was like a huge clubhouse guy, really loved by the market in Baltimore, right? Like, that's all he knew. And the fans loved him. He was like a fan favorite. So now to be a Blue Jay and play for a team where, this is part of the reason why I always say, like, first impressions matter. I know these guys feel it. I know these guys hear it. And for somebody that's struggling in a new place, I'm guessing that he's dealing with that as well as a big ticket free agent that's supposed to be providing power for a team that's still bottom five in home runs. And so, like, I'm not as convinced it's going to end up being that high. Like, I'm just not. I think it's well above where we are right now. Like, he's got a 580 OPS. It's going to be higher than that. It has to be higher than that. But if you told me it was in the low 700s versus the high 700s, I think right now I'd be buying the low 700s.
Yeah, that's fair. Here's the Zips for rest of season has him at 766. So maybe 780 is a little high. But they have him as a 235 hitter, 766 OPS, 20 bombs the rest of the way. I think, you know, that's probably a fair estimate. But it could be lower than that. It definitely could be. And I agree with you. I mean, these guys, of course, they feel it. Like, Santander, part of the dream of being a big free agent is not just the money, but it's converting on that. And it's going to maybe a new spot and actually proving that you're worth that money. I think that it can weigh on guys when they don't produce. Of course, they still have the bank account. Of course, they still have a great lifestyle. But yeah, you want to produce. You want to prove that you were worth it and prove that last year was just the start of something. It wasn't, you know, just a means to an end when it comes to getting a big contract. So definitely this weighs on guys. And look, it's not just Santander, because really Scherzer hasn't produced, and Andrés Giménez, you know, now rehabbing and making his way back. But those offseason moves, like, it just hasn't gone, you know, plan A so far. And the bullpen moves work great, and they have a great bullpen now. but elsewhere it hasn't worked the way the Jays hoped.
You know, it feels that sounds exactly like when these guys first came into power with this organization, where they were getting like Daniel Hudson and it was working out for them. But then it was like, what, Kendrys Morales is no good. And that was a bigger signing for your team. And yeah, Hoffman has been good, but he's also been like the bullpen arm that lately people have been like, wait, what's happening here with some of the walks, the leadoff walks and homers? And yeah, I'm not really concerned about Hoffman. I think that's been a really good signing so far. But yeah, Jimenez, that trade, oof. Like, I can't stop thinking about how different this team would be if they would have signed Gleyber Torres instead of trading for Andrés Giménez. Like, it's on my mind every single time I watch the Tigers. Like, boy, it would have been great to have this guy. Boy, this is kind of the second baseman that they needed. And I keep getting told by people like, oh, well, Jimenez gives you insurance at shortstop the next season. I'm like, okay, but what happened to worrying about this year? What happened to worrying about the here and now? Why are we thinking about... If that was the case with 2027, why weren't they more aggressive at last year's trade deadline? So I don't really buy that argument anyway. Last thing, if they were to move Santander to the IL, like if they did give him a 10-game, hey, here's a breather. This team obviously has a lot of outfielders. So there's players that are on the roster right now that you'd think would get a lot more of these ABs and a lot more of these games played. But is there anybody in AAA right now that you think is like, oh, you know what? Maybe this is kind of Addison Bargery where it's at least intriguing to you.
I think you look at the results in AAA in the last month, you've got Joey Loperfido and Aroldis Martinez who are hitting really well. So those guys could be interesting. Now with Loperfido, he's a left-handed hitter. The Jays already have a lot of those. With Aroldis, he's a right-handed hitter and an infielder. And so I think ideal world, when you look at some of the situations the Jays find themselves in, late in games, you've got Stefanik up and you can't really pinch hit for him because you don't have any other infielders unless you bring Miles Straw in. Like, ideal world, you trust Aroldis defensively and you believe in what he's doing at the plate, and then he's able to give you not only a right-handed bat, but someone who could play second or third. So is he ready for that? I don't know. I haven't been, you know, watching every Bison's game.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that the numbers are good and that offensively, he's got an OPS above 800 for the last 28 days. And the same goes for Joey Loperfido. So I think that those guys are worth kind of having on the radar for the Jays. But and look, best case scenario is something like Spencer Horwitz last year. Like, you can get that kind of production. Alan Rodon also has an OPS approaching 1100 at AAA. So he's got to be a factor as well. But yeah, I don't think any of those guys have the same upside as Santander, of course.
Sure, they don't have the same upside as Santander, but I will say that hearing Loperfido and Aroldis is way more exciting than hearing, hey, Davis Schneider, we're going to try this again, or Alan Rodon, we're going to try this again. Like, Loperfido is the tools guy. I've heard from certain people that, like, he's still the guy they're highest on from that trade, which has gone up and down, and, like, how could you not be more excited about him than a starting pitcher that's having surgery and a second baseman that they didn't want to bring up over Stefanik, you know? So yeah, maybe that's definitely a part of it, but yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing Aroldis. I wouldn't mind seeing Loperfido, especially given that Barger and the tool stuff has actually given you some form of return and injected a little bit of excitement into a fan base that is dying to be excited by something. So yeah, either of those guys to me would be more appealing. The only thing I would push back on a touch is, like, does Aroldis Martinez really help you in the infield? Because last time I saw him play defense, it was like, yeah, I'd rather have Miles Straw play in the infield. I really do feel like blind Miles Straw could do this better.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there are real questions there. And this is where I honestly don't know, like, what the, you know, video or what the defensive scouting report would say on Aroldis to this point in the season. I can tell you what the offensive numbers are. And then, to me, like, I look at Alan Rodon, and he obviously struggled, and it obviously wasn't good, but I still believe this guy can help this team this year. So I don't think it's the cleanest fit right now, because he and Nathan Lucas are kind of similar when you look at handedness and position and overall profile, and Lucas is just crushing it right now, so you obviously roll with him. But, you know, in a scenario that Nathan Lucas, you know, whatever the case, needed 10 days, I think you could call up Alan Rodon, and I would have a higher kind of level of optimism for him than I probably would for Loperfido at this point.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not writing off Alan Roden's career either. I just, like, you said it with the Nathan Lucas thing. Like, you got what Roden's supposed to be. Like,
yeah.
Lucas is giving you exactly what I was expecting, sort of best case scenario-ish from Alan Roden. Maybe I thought it was a little higher with Roden because there were some projections that were pretty crazy about him. But yeah, either way, you've got that spot occupied. So I wouldn't mind just seeing one of the other dudes. Anyway, Ben Nicholson-Smith, again, of At The Letters, Blue Jays reporter. Thanks as always for making time, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, JD.
Quickly, before we go, because we got to take a break. One, subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars. Reach out anytime on Twitter and Instagram. Always love it, at JD Bunkus. I was talking to my producer, Armin, about this a little bit before the show, but then I stopped it because I didn't want to do the show in the green room. Anthony Edwards is only 23 years old. He's had a phenomenally successful career by any measure of any 23-year-old. Like, he was the most prolific three-point shooter in the NBA this season. He's gone to back-to-back conference finals. But I got to tell you, Armin, I'm a little up and down on the guy. And I'm not saying anything like, oh, I don't think he's ever going to be the dude. But there was a video of him from when did the Suns get blown out? In that game against Dallas. What year was that? 2022? 21?
Trying to think what game you're talking about here.
Oh, the famous blowout where the Suns are down like 100 points to Dallas, and it's like Chris Paul hits a three to cut the lead to 44 or whatever. And
2022.
Yeah, okay. So there's playoffs, a video of Anthony Edwards where he's just filming himself watching the game on his iPad and being like, you got blown out by 40. This is a disgrace. You gave up this many points in the third quarter. This is a disgrace. And one of the things I really like about Anthony Edwards is, like, he talks that talk, but he really does it as a front runner. He does it when things are going well. He'll walk around the Lakers stadium and he'll talk trash after the win. But then when he gets 2 shots in a full half in what was a must-win game in Minnesota, he's like, oh, I don't think I struggled. I'm like, what? You don't think you struggled? Shea Gilgeous-Alexander and co outscored you by, like, you and Julius Randle by 1,000,000 points. And at least I've to get blown out the way that the Wolves did last night, where literally you turn the game on and it's over. I just don't like how up and down it feels. I like to see a little bit of the same energy that he has in the wins carry through to the losses. And he's 23. So I'm giving him a huge grace period when it comes to this, but I've got some warning signs for Anthony Edwards. That's all I got to say. I got some warning signs. Anyways, we got to take a break because Brad Treliving is going to come to the podium here. We're going to hear from the Maple Leafs general manager after, again, 2 weeks post the exit. And yeah, some pretty massive points of curiosity, given that he is now, like, as Keith Pelley has described, this is his hockey team. Brad Treliving is next.